The next case. And welcome again to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, March 20th, 2024. This is our third and final case set for oral argument today. This is A23-1037, State v. Terrell McNeil Jr. This is being recorded as well as being broadcast by live via Zoom. This recording is the only one that is permissible. However, you will have access to the recording within a day or two after today's hearing. We will have 15 minutes for appellant's initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes for respondent and 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant. There is a clock there indicating the time that you have remaining, so please be mindful of that. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Daniel Repka. I represent the appellant Terrell McNeil Jr. in this case. I ask the court to reverse the decision of the district court denying Mr. McNeil's motion to suppress and remand it, either consistent with the opinion of this court or straight reversal of the decision and vacating Mr. McNeil's conviction. This case boils down to one question. That question is whether Mr. McNeil's apartment doorknob constitutes airspace under Erdman or curtilage under Dunn. McNeil advances the argument that the doorknob in this case is more consistent with curtilage than in Erdman. To be clear, McNeil concedes that if the court finds that a doorknob is more similar to airspace like in Erdman, then Mr. McNeil's appeal likely fails. However, based on the very specific circumstances of this case, the doorknob of Mr. McNeil's apartment door was curtilage. What we learned at the contested omnibus hearing before the court denied
So if I might interrupt for a minute. So if in Edstrom the dog had sniffed instead of the door seam, the door handle, would probable cause be required then? Would sniffing the door handle, is that curtilage?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I can answer
I'm not sure it is,
that
but thank you for saying so.
question. It's hard for me to answer that. I don't know because I don't know that in handling a lot of these cases in my career, I don't know that we would know exactly if the dog would hit on the doorknob, the threshold, the airspace around it, because I don't want to sound ridiculous, but I don't know that the dog could say, "Hey, I smell drugs on the doorknob." So therefore, I guess I pronounced the case wrong. Is it Edstrom? My apologies. Then Edstrom would apply. I suppose if we could actually pinpoint and know with absolute certainty if the dog indicated on the doorknob, I think maybe the answer to that question is yes, but I don't know that we could ever get there because we'll never know exactly where the dog would hit, which is why I think Edstrom. The Supreme Court got it right in Edstrom. It's kind of like this: if Mr. McNeil had a sign, an advertisement hanging on his door that said "Drugs for sale, please knock," I wouldn't have an argument because he doesn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy when people potentially walk by his apartment complex or his apartment door, even though the exterior is locked. The crux here, the key distinction between Edstrom and McNeil's case is that law enforcement took the additional step not to just pass by, but to put on gloves, remove a Q-tip from a bag, take that Q-tip, swab the door, and then put that Q-tip back into a bag and send it off for analysis over at the Minnesota National Guard. So therein lies that key distinction. And what's important to note too in this case is that it's not as though in a lot of the court's cases and progeny of air sniffs that Mr. McNeil's apartment complex was locked. The evidence very clearly establishes at the contested omnibus hearing that the common area to the apartments inside were not easily accessible to the general public. It's not as though anybody could walk in and peruse the hallways. Rather, an access code was required to gain entry into the common areas of the apartment. There's no evidence in the record to establish that there's some sort of doorknob or doorbell, excuse me, at the exterior that would allow anybody in who rings the doorbell. The only evidence that the district court had at its disposal was law enforcement gained entry. This agent Nelson gained entry because he received the access code for the exterior door from another law enforcement agency that it's unknown whether they had any involvement in this case. And that's how he ultimately gained entry. Again, I think I'd have to concede that if the common area of the apartment complex was accessible to anybody in the public, Mr. McNeil probably doesn't have a very high expectation of privacy in that area. But because the exterior of the building is locked, and the record before the district court reveals the only
Doesn't
reason.
Edstrom say that that doesn't matter though? I mean, that was the fact pattern in Edstrom, right? That it was a locked building, but law enforcement had access and
And that's again, that's the key distinction there is here, there was one law enforcement agency, presumably, that had the code to this door to get into the common areas, but not the law enforcement agent that actually conducted the search. I don't think that was fleshed out very well at the district court. I should probably take responsibility for that. But what we know is that the law enforcement agent, Agent Nelson, who conducted the swab, I'd like to call it a search, but I think that's up for debate. The swab didn't have easy access to that access code. He had to get it from somebody else, which, if you have to get it from somebody else, leads the appellant to conclude that that presumably gives a person a larger expectation of privacy. It's not just available to anybody in the public.
can I ask
But
you one more question and then I'll let you carry on with the argument and let my colleagues ask questions? So is there something particular about the door knob? I mean, what if the swab had been of a door hinge? You know, the door to his apartment, the exterior side. Is there anything particular about a door knob? Or I mean, if we were to go your way, what would our holding be? I mean, we often ask, I mean, should this be, it seems like this is a question actually that's undecided. So if we were to agree with you and decide this should be precedential, what should our syllabus point be? It's that doorknobs somehow different from any other part of the exterior of an apartment door in a common hallway?
I hadn't thought about the answer to that question.
I wouldn't have expected you to, but
Just off the cuff, I hope the court doesn't hold me to this because I haven't had a lot of time to think about it. A doorknob, I think, would be, for purposes of expectation of privacy, there's probably no difference in a doorknob compared to the door compared to the hinge because the knob and the door itself and the hinge all are present to afford the occupant inside privacy. You can't get in unless you turn the knob, you push the door, and the hinges activate to open the door. What I think the distinction is that the doorknob is what law enforcement is trying to use to collect evidence. I don't know that if law enforcement were to swab a hinge or a door, that it would be dispositive of any particular evidence of inculpatory evidence. So I don't know that we'd ever really have a case where law enforcement would swab a hinge or swab a door. I suppose it's possible. But for Fourth Amendment and Article 1, Section 10 purposes, the door should be viewed as a whole. But particularly as it relates to the doorknob, I think it affords the occupant inside a greater expectation of privacy, because that's essentially what you need to manipulate in order to gain access inside of the dwelling.
but that's not the only thing that one would have to traverse in order to access the private, what we typically consider to be the private part of the dwelling, right? I mean, you'd have to approach the door, which is the dog sniff case. So I'm trying, and I think that Judge Siegel's questions are trying to get at this point also, what makes the doorknob special? What makes it different than the seam of the door or the entryway leading up to the door?
I go back to my analogy that if Mr. McNeil had a sign plastered on his door saying drugs for sale, please knock, he would have no expectation of privacy because anyone can walk by and observe with their natural senses evidence of a potential crime or a dog for, in this case. So in Edstrom, the fact or the act of law enforcement walking a canine officer in the common area of the hallway and smelling, that's just a sense that the canine officer has. In my example of the sign plastered on the door, that's just a sense that the officer has observing, seeing the door. Here, the critical distinction is that law enforcement actually had to do something beyond their five senses. They had to collect evidence physically by swabbing the door. That's the distinction.
So what this sounds to me like, and correct me if I'm wrong, counsel, is a question of the extent of the implied license to approach, which I don't think is really addressed in the briefing, but I think that this is what we're dealing with, that maybe if you're coming up to the door, that's fine. But what you do when you get there is sort of the where the rubber hits the road.
I agree with that, but it's also based on how you got to the door in the first place. I know Judge Siegel made the great distinction of, Edstrom says it doesn't matter how you get in. I think there are the devil's in the details in that case, because the facts of this case are somewhat different than the facts of Edstrom, but it's how law enforcement gets there and what they do when they arrive. And I'd be more than happy to brief the implied license argument if the court so wishes me to do so. If we were just talking about a five senses case where law enforcement or canine officer walks up and collects evidence, that's airspace. I think Mr. McNeil has little, if any, argument that this was a search under the Fourth Amendment or Article 1, Section 10. But because law enforcement had to actually manipulate something to do something physical with the door to collect the evidence, that's what triggers the curtilage.
Do you think that Edstrom potentially deals with even a greater expectation of privacy than the doorknob? Because ostensibly the airspace that the dog is sniffing in part is emanating from inside of the dwelling, between the seams or under the door. And so the dog is potentially searching something from inside the home as opposed to the doorknob, which is outside of what we typically consider to be the private part of the dwelling.
I think you hit the nail on the head, Your Honor. I think my response might cut against my argument, even though I'm not trying to. As soon as that smell emanates outside of the dwelling, the resident has little, if any, Fourth Amendment Article 1, Section 10 privacy interest. But the fact that it's actually coming in from the residence is what triggers arguments that constitutional protections apply. Here, I don't think that Mr. McNeil can make any argument that the evidence that law enforcement obtained from the swab started from inside of his residence because it was on the exterior doorknob. Of course, Mr. McNeil has to go inside of the apartment and come out of the apartment. But for purposes of Mr. McNeil's argument, I stand by the crux being it's the act of actually having to collect evidence beyond the five senses that triggers this being a curtilage case and not an airspace case, if that makes sense.
Counsel, I've got several questions. So when I hear your arguments, it sounds like you referenced at least once the Fourth Amendment and constitutional protections, but I've heard you reference several times a reasonable expectation of privacy. But when I read your brief, I didn't see a full-fledged argument on the reasonable expectation of privacy, which I think is a separate argument from the protections under the Fourth Amendment, which would involve an analysis of the four Dunn factors. Is that correct?
I think the intention of the defense or the appellant here is to make a sweeping Fourth Amendment argument, as well as Article 1, Section 10. Inherent within the Fourth Amendment in Article 1, Section 10 is the right to privacy. And in order for, how do I say this? In the state's brief, it indicates that that law enforcement likely had reasonable articulable suspicion, even if not probable cause. But in order to get there, in order for Mr. McNeil to make an argument, in order for him to have standing, he has to have a reasonable expectation of privacy, and what he's asserting was a constitutional violation. So if not for a right to privacy, then there is no Fourth Amendment argument that I can make. So if I didn't flesh that out well enough in my brief, I sincerely apologize. But the right to privacy is certainly a crucial point to make here, because if not for that, Mr. McNeil doesn't have a Fourth Amendment argument to make because he has no standing.
Well, and I understand that argument to be going really to, I think, the third Dunn factor. Is that correct?
What the area the space is used for?
Correct.
Yes. I think of all the four Dunn factors that the court has to weigh here, the third one is likely the weakest for Mr. McNeil. It's still there. I still think under the totality of the circumstances and the Dunn circumstance, the Dunn factors, it still comes out ahead for Mr. McNeil. But certainly because we're talking about a common area, I'm hard pressed to say that Mr. McNeil has an absolute right to privacy in the common area when other people can be present.
So if you could just briefly talk about the Dunn factors and which ones do you think favor your argument? Because the district court said the only one that favored appellant was the first factor, and the other three did not favor that the doorknob was curtilage.
Certainly number one, because the proximity of the home, it's literally the access point to the home. The only way to get inside the home for all intents and purposes is to manipulate the doorknob to open the door, push it through and get past the threshold of the door. As it relates to it being fenced in, of course, the door isn't fenced in from a literal standpoint because we're talking about an apartment complex. In Dunn, we were talking about a residence, a single family unit, a dwelling. Here we're talking about an apartment complex. And again, the very specific facts of this case lead McNeil to argue that number two also falls in his favor. The access point to...
How is that possible when Edstrom indicates with that second analysis, the area outside the door is not fenced or otherwise enclosed within the home? The doorknob isn't enclosed within the home.
Certainly, and I agree that the common area space is not within the home because Mr. McNeil's home is what's on the other side of the apartment door, not the common area space. But there still is an expectation of privacy in that common area. We know that because in order to get into the common area, law enforcement had to secure the access code to get in. So I think there's a scale. If we're walking down the street in a neighborhood with a bunch of single family homes and you can walk up to a door, there's little, if any, expectation of privacy because literally any member of the public can walk up to the door. Here, we get a little closer to having a reasonable expectation of privacy, which is the second factor here that I'm talking about, the fenced in area, because not any member of the public can just walk up to Mr. McNeil's apartment door. Somebody either has to be let in or have an access code, which is very much unlike what we were talking about, what the Supreme Court was talking about in Dunn. That's why the second factor slides more in favor of McNeil's argument, because it just wasn't open to the general public 24/7.
What about the third and fourth factors?
What the area is used for, that's certainly not the strongest for Mr. McNeil, because the purpose of the area that law enforcement accessed was to actually get into a person's individual dwelling. But this factor ties very much in line with number two, because the only way to gain access to this common area is if someone gives you a code or somebody lets you in. It's not just available to the general public. What we're also talking about too is we're not just talking about the airspace or the common area outside of the door. What we're really specifically talking about is the doorknob itself, right? And that's, again, another critical distinction that Mr. McNeil wants to make or hopes the court considers. If we were just talking about the common area space outside of the door, Mr. McNeil has a weaker argument. But we're specifically talking about the doorknob that was used by law enforcement to collect this evidence. So is the doorknob itself curtilage? What that doorknob is used for is protection. It's also used to gain entry. So we're not just talking about the airspace that law enforcement was around to get to the doorknob. We're talking about the doorknob itself. And that doorknob is certainly used to either keep people out or let people in. And while the record at the district court doesn't reflect this, I'm hard pressed to think that Mr. McNeil wanted to let law enforcement in to collect evidence.
So Mr. Repka, on rebuttal, because you're out of time.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Could you address the question of if We agree with the district court that the doorknob is not part of the curtilage. Was there reasonable, or was the district court right that there was reasonable articulable suspicion?
I certainly will. And thank you very much for your time. I'm sorry for going over.
Not a problem. Thank you. You were answering the question that I had asked after time had expired. As noted, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. But now we're going to be turning over to respondents. And if you can please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, and you have 15 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Susan DeVos. I'm appearing today on behalf of the state of Minnesota. And today we're requesting this court affirm the district court's decision and uphold Mr. Neal's conviction. As this court's aware, this case was resolved through a stipulated facts trial, bench trial essentially, that was done after this court's or the district court's ruling determining that rejecting appellant's request to suppress evidence that was obtained through the swab of his doorknob, the doorknob that was in the common area of an apartment complex. As the district court correctly determined, the swab of that doorknob outside of Mr. McNeil's door in the communal apartment complex did not require a warrant.
Then, counsel, I'm curious as to why the police actually did seek a warrant. And it seems that there's testimony that they sought a warrant because that's their standard operating practice.
That's true, Your Honor. They did seek a warrant and it is standard operating practice to do so. That does not change the fact that it was not needed in this case. The fact that the officers went above and beyond doesn't change the analysis as to whether that was necessary here. As it's clear by both U.S. Supreme Court case law, Minnesota Supreme Court case law, in this court, certainly individuals have a reasonable expectation in their home. And so the question here is really just whether that doorknob in this case meets the test for curtilage, which has also been recognized as portions of a home that may arise to having a reasonable expectation of privacy.
So, counsel, do you agree that if we determine that the doorknob in this particular case is part of the curtilage of the apartment unit, that a warrant would have been required?
Yes, Your Honor. I think we do have to concede that.
So then let me ask you this. I wanted to focus on the unique nature of a doorknob as opposed to a door seam or the walkway or the common area. When I think of a doorknob, I think of this is the way, the manner in which someone can access the interior of the home. So does that function of a doorknob, and tell me if you think that there's another function that that doorknob serves. I mean, I suppose it could be decorative or ornamental, but usually that is what we think of a doorknob. That is the way we achieve ingress and egress into the home, which is the private part, which is unquestionably the private part of a dwelling. Why isn't that part of the curtilage given its essential function?
Thank you. I think that is a good point. However, if the court looks at the door itself also provides, prevents people from seeing into the home, for example. That doesn't make the outside of the door curtilage. I believe, as Mr. Repka conceded, the door seam, as in Edstrom, was not seen to be curtilage. If the court looks at the Dunn factors, I think that's what we need to do here, regardless of, because if we don't, I think that we can delve into, as there was discussion about whether a hinge or outside of the door, the bottom of the door, all of those things. And I think that is important for us then to turn to Dunn.
Well, so that we. The state's position that somebody, you know, and it doesn't have to be a rental apartment, but it could be a condominium, but a multi-unit building, that there is no curtilage at all. I mean, is that the state's argument? Because one thing that troubles me is there's such a difference between what's thought of as curtilage, you know, when you're dealing with, you know, like a single family home, I mean, heck, somebody's driveway is curtilage, or can be, you know, depending on, you know, what purpose the people go up the driveway for. Is it within the license or not? But, and if we're to say in this case that no, you can swab a door handle, the exterior of a door, then there is no curtilage for somebody's home. Or what is the state's view of that?
The case law tells us that there is curtilage that is certainly protected under the warrant.
But what is it when you're talking about a multi-unit building? Because obviously a general locked entrance under Edstrom doesn't distinguish and say, oh, well, then the common hallways are at least quasi-curtilage. I mean, they're viewed as just kind of open, like it's open to a public sidewalk. So is there no curtilage when you're dealing with a multi-unit building, residential building?
It could depend on the type of a building and the type of multi-unit. So a townhouse, for example, might be different, or different forms of common or jointly used communal housing. An apartment building such as this one, there may not be any curtilage.
Well, wait a second, because Edstrom makes some distinctions there, right? Because it says that a common area has many uses that are not associated with the home. What is the use of a doorknob if it is not, I mean, I can only think of the doorknob as being associated with the unit, the dwelling. Is there some other purpose to the doorknob or the door?
Essentially, the doorknob, of course, is to access a door. That's the primary use of a doorknob. And a door is to provide access to the home. However, doorknobs commonly are often touched by others, individuals, and we don't, for example, in a communal area such as that, the neighbor, for example, could hang a sign on the door. The landlord could come up and post a notice on the door. All of those things are things that could be used. The doors could be used for, the handles could be used for.
But doesn't that really go to an implied license that parties may have to do certain things? So for example, there's an implied license to be able to knock on someone's door, but that doesn't mean that, I'm not sure that equates to a free pass for the government to come up to somebody's doorknob and try to wiggle it to see if it's open. And, you know, oh, gee, I just opened the door. Oh, look what's inside. It seems counterintuitive to think that you would be able to, the police would be allowed to do anything like that.
This court really needs to look back to the, I believe, to the Dunn factors, because there are so many different ways in which this could be considered. And that's why the U.S. Supreme Court came up with those factors, so that we could we can look at those factors and consider in this case, because otherwise, certainly there's a number of scenarios in which just about anything could be considered.
Yeah, so if we look at the Dunn factors, and I want to focus actually on the third one, because for that one, it's looking at the purpose. And for a doorknob, it seems like the only purpose of that is, the primary purpose of that is to let the owner in, and also to, and their guests, but to keep other people out, which is why it's locked. And by the way, I should note that not only do they swab the door handle itself, but also basically it's a keypad that allows you to actually enter into the residence. But it seems that that one certainly strongly favors that under the Dunn factors, that it's curtilage. And the first factor also talks about the fact that you're talking about how closely associated it is with the home. I don't know if you can get much closer to the home than a doorknob that's attached to the door that is attached to the to the residence. I mean, that's it almost seems like it's actually part of the residence. And so why isn't it just even on those two factors alone, why don't the Dunn factors favor the doorknob being a curtilage to a residence?
Thank you. Certainly, it is a four-factor test, and we need to weigh all the factors. The proximity to the area claimed to be the curtilage of the home, number one. I don't think the district court found that weighed in favor of it being curtilage, and there isn't really much of an argument against that. When you look at number three, however, the nature of the uses of which the area is put, the doorknob itself, as well as the entire door, is in that communal hallway. And
right, but I want to stop you there, and my apologies, counsel, but
okay.
I think that Edstrom made a distinction between the area outside and said that area outside or in between the door seam, that is part of the common space, but it differentiated the physical aspects of the door itself. It never decided that. And even the district court in this case did talk about the fact that there is a difference between the area outside of the door seam and the actual physical object. Here we're talking about the actual physical object of the doorknob. That seems to be very, very different than the space just outside of the door, doorknob, the door seam. And here, the police actually swabbed the doorknob itself. They didn't analyze, say, the air outside of the door, which I think under Edstrom would be permissible, but they actually had physical contact with an object, the doorknob itself and the keypad. So why doesn't that favor that it is actually part of the curtilage of the residence?
As Mr. Repka conceded, the dogs in the case, when we're looking at dog sniffing and around a door, inevitably dogs may actually touch the door. They may touch the doorknob even. And so to just say
but
that
but
it is.
But that's not the holding of Edstrom, though.
But it didn't. That's true, Your Honor. It didn't preclude that, however. And the nature of which the area is put, referencing the entire area, including certainly the doorknob allows access to the home, as does the door and to the home itself. However, Mr. McNeil in this case did nothing to ensure privacy with regard to that doorknob. Nothing was done to protect the doorknob from anyone else accessing, from anyone seeing it, from anyone
well, a
touching
tenant
it.
Probably doesn't have the right to do that, though. I mean, we can presume. So I've got a question. What's the state's position? And if I missed this in your brief, I didn't think it was in your brief, though, on the district court's ruling that the search warrant for the swab of the doorknob was not supported by probable cause. Does the state agree with that or not? And then did you brief it?
We did not brief that. That was, we did not, I'm not conceding that. However, we did not cross appeal and ask to have that issue addressed. That's correct.
Counsel, I have some additional concerns about the fact that we're dealing with an apartment dwelling or apartment unit as opposed to a single family home, and that we may be differentiating the private nature of a door or a door handle depending upon where a person might be living. Do you agree that the case law is pretty settled that the front door of a home is part of the private, part of the curtilage?
Do you mean outside of an apartment?
Outside of an apartment, in a single family home, the front door is private.
There is some case law to that effect, yes.
And that the police could not walk up to a single family home and swab a door of a single family home.
I don't believe that specific issue has been resolved, although there is an unpublished decision from the Ramsey County District Court that was a case that was cited by Mr. Repka.
Do you believe that the implied license to approach would include a police officer taking out a swab kit to swab the front door of a single family home?
I don't believe we're there, but this case is certainly beyond that, and that this is a case in which there is a communal area.
I'm getting there.
Yeah.
I'm getting there. I know your time has expired, but I have a few questions about this because I am concerned that you may be asking us to write an opinion that is going to differentiate the application of the Fourth Amendment to a door of a person's home, depending upon the type of home that they choose to live in or potentially could afford to live in. And that's concerning to me.
I think that Judge Reyes mentioned in this case that the owners or the renters in this home may not have been able to add something to protect the doorknob in this case because they didn't own the outside of that door, the communal hallway. So that does make this case distinguishable, as Judge Reyes acknowledged, that this doorknob was in the communal area, was not an area in which they may have even been allowed to add something. So that does make this case different. We aren't asking the court to rule on whether a private home, this would be the same in a private home.
I'm just trying to understand what the difference in constitutional protection would be based on where the person chooses to live. Either the door that is the barrier between the person's, the interior of the dwelling and the exterior of the dwelling is private, or it seems like it's either private or not private, and that shouldn't depend upon what the nature of the living situation is. Unless there's some case law otherwise.
I'm not aware of any. I don't concede the point that the outside of an individual home is necessarily curtilage of the home either. But this specific case has some added facts that make it even less likely that it's the curtilage of the home. In this case, an apartment in a common area that's accessible by numerous people.
All right. Thank you very much.
I don't see any other questions, so thank you very much, counsel. We'll now turn to appellant's counsel. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Before I get into Judge Siegel's question about the reasonable expectation of privacy, I'm sorry, about the reasonable articulable suspicion, I want to clarify the concession that I made in my beginning remarks. I have to concede where I must, but I don't want that concession to extend to something I never intended to. The concession that Mr. McNeil is making today is if the court views the doorknob as airspace, Mr. McNeil's appeal should fail. If Mr. McNeil's doorknob is curtilage, then Mr. McNeil's appeal succeeds. The airspace emanating from Mr. McNeil's door, Mr. McNeil enjoys very little expectation of privacy and therefore constitutional protection in that area. It's the doorknob that we're specifically talking about. As it relates to the reasonable articulable suspicion, it's close, but it falls short. We know from the district court's decision, which I know this court, if it were to consider it, would review de novo, we know that the search warrant lacked probable cause. So now we slide down to see if there was reasonable articulable suspicion. When you look at and the information that we have as it relates to whether reasonable articulable suspicion was present is found in the search warrant application. My concern with the search warrant application is that the information contained therein was predominantly hearsay information, which can certainly support reasonable articulable suspicion, but it's the weight of that information that has to be considered. But it's hearsay information from a confidential, reliable informant whose veracity was not
flashed out in the search warrant application saying that Mr. McNeil could produce controlled substances, not how, not when, not where. Later in the search warrant application, it talks about 5 months prior, there was information in a different county that somebody else, not a CRI, not a cooperating defendant, told law enforcement that they could get drugs from McNeil. And then there's information about Mr. McNeil's vehicle being parked outside of the apartment complex. When you tie those circumstances together, McNeil firmly supports the conclusion that it is not reasonable, articulable suspicion. Does it raise suspicion? Sure. Would that be enough to further invest in investigation? Maybe. But is that reasonable, articulable suspicion such that it satisfies the a warrantless search, for example? Absolutely not. I think the law enforcement agents needed more information to acquire reasonable, articulable suspicion before they could further act on their investigation in this case.
What else do you think they need?
Well, I would like to see maybe some suspicious activity outside of the house. Maybe Mr. McNeil carrying bags, unusual activity, like a lot of people coming and going.
It sounds like probable cause to me.
It's getting closer, right? It's getting closer. But what we have, that's what I'd like to see. We know that probable cause wasn't there, but I'm not saying there's no suspicion. I'm not saying there's no reason for law enforcement to conduct an investigation. But is it reasonable, articulable suspicion that there's crime specifically related to the inside of McNeil's apartment complex? No, because I don't want to get too much in the weeds here. When we're talking about the search of a home or anything dealing with the home, there has to be this nexus requirement. And really the only thing that law enforcement has is Mr. McNeil lives in this residence. There was no information that McNeil was dealing drugs out of the home.
So, I mean, when I look at this on the spectrum, I mean, what we have here is more than a hunch, which is usually the problem when we're dealing with reasonable, articulable suspicion. We have some connection, something less than probable cause, and that middle ground seems to be I'm just trying to pinpoint what is missing in the reasonable, articulable suspicion place. I mean, I don't think it necessarily has to connect it to that specific unit, because then we're in probable cause territory.
It's the weight of the information that law enforcement had when it applied for the search warrant. Again, I'm not talking about probable cause. I'm talking about reasonable, articulable suspicion. But you have a CRI whose credentials weren't vetted in the search warrant application. And then you have some random person telling a completely separate law enforcement agency in a completely different county, and that's it. I don't think that's enough. It's close. Maybe it's close, but it's not enough to think there's reasonable, articulable suspicion that Mr. McNeil is engaged in a lawful activity. And if it is, I think that's terrifying, because if I get two of my friends to tell law enforcement that a third friend is out committing crime and that's enough, that's concerning to me. The court has asked a lot of very good, insightful questions. I wanted to clarify where Mr. McNeil conceded. I wanted to answer the question about reasonable, articulable suspicion. So unless the court has any further questions for me, I would rest my time. Thank you.
Looks like there are no further questions. Thank you very much. We really appreciate the briefing, but in particular, we really appreciate the oral arguments and the questions and the responses that you have provided. It's been very helpful. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. That is the last case that we have on our oral calendar today. So court is in recess.